Paula pinned down. And although he did promise to be around and to do that this day, actually he's down in Santa Fe right now. And he said he wasn't about to come back up here just to talk about poetry for 1 hour. So what I'd like to do instead is, without Nanao being here, I'm going to read translations from Chinese and Japanese, and I'm going to talk about the youngest, not the youngest, but the most, to me, the most interesting element culturally in Japan today, what's going on in Japan, in other words, some of the poetry from that scene, some of which I've translated, and some of my own translations from Japanese and Chinese, maybe, trying to pull this together a little bit in terms of what happens when you translate, and especially what happens when you work with Chinese and Japanese. So this isn't my own poetry, it's translation work. But it's very personal for me, too. I mean, I've been very deeply involved in this work and in the people that I've learned it from, and it has influenced my own work a lot. First, I'm going to talk about Sakaki Nanao. Nanao must be about 44, 45 years old. He was in the Air Force in World War II on the Japanese side. From a Kagoshima family, southern Japan, southernmost Japan, an old family. I think he was the youngest of seven brothers. In fact, he was the seventh son. You can't hear me? So? Can you hear me better if I don't use it? Okay. As a matter of fact, Nanao once told me he was the seventh son of a seventh son, which is supposed to be very magical, even in Japan. It's an old Western folklore thing. When Nanao was about 15 years old, he picked up a translation of some piece of ethnography on the Bushmen of the Kalahari Desert. Some little account of the Bushmen. And he said that that was the first thing that ever turned his head around. He realized that if what was written in that book about the Bushmen was true, then everything that he had been taught and was being taught about civilization was false. His intellectual development from there went directly into reading Kropotkin and Bakunin, the anarchists, and he proceeded from the conventional anarchists, from the straight anarchists, into left deviationists, Trotskyites, the whole bit. So that he got into a lot of trouble right during the middle of World War II for holding Trotskyite discussion groups in his barracks with other officers in the Japanese Air Force. But because he had good family connections, he only served, I think, a month in the brig and was out again. Ordinarily, you'd be shot for that without any question. All of his friends toward the end of the war went out as kamikaze and didn't come back. He was on the kamikaze lineup himself, but the war ended before his name came up. After the war was over, Nanao didn't go back to his family. He never went back to his home again. He went instead up to Tokyo, where he doesn't talk about this period very much, and I've picked up more about it from some of his young disciples than from him. Apparently, he lived for about 3 years in the directly after the war period, when Tokyo was still in rubble, under the bridges and elevated systems with the beggars and whores of Tokyo. And he tried to organize them into a union. But in doing so, apparently he ran afoul of that thing you find everywhere, organized crime plus the police, in combination. And they didn't want to have the beggars and whores unionized, so they very conveniently framed Nanao, and he went to prison for several years. After he got out of prison, he took up a wandering life, and I mean literally wandering. He has walked the length of Japan maybe half a dozen times, from one end to the other, entirely on foot, and back and forth in every possible combination through all the various provinces. During this period of walking, he still walks all the time too, but he doesn't so much anymore. During the period of walking, Nanao taught himself to read Greek and Sanskrit. He already could read English. The way he did this was he built up a network of friendly school teachers and friendly librarians in the various small towns in Japan. And one thing about Japan is that they are not anti-intellectual. And any tiny rural community has a school teacher and a library, and this is open to anybody, no matter how freaky they might look, if they feel that this is a person interested in learning. They have the old tradition going back thousands of years in China of the respectably ragged, eccentric poet, intellectual wanderer. It's an old Chinese, not only it's a tradition, it's almost a cultural ideal. So that, you know, after a successful career running provinces and being an advisor to the emperor and so forth in the Confucian bureaucracy, what everybody aspired to do after retirement was to wear raggedy clothes and wander around begging and writing poems. And some of them actually did. You know? So that this cultural image is a great help and a great support even today to people in Japan. And right after the war, it was a great help to Nanao. He found places that he could stop periodically around the country where he would have access to books. And he stole a number of books from the Indian consulate in Kobe on Sanskrit, and he was able to teach himself Sanskrit by carrying those in his rucksack and studying them. 10 years go by like this. 15 years, just about. About 5 years ago, about a little more than that, 8 years ago, Joanne and I were on our way to India, and we met a young Australian fellow who had just come from Japan who was on his way to India. He had been the first person to get a degree in Chinese from Sydney and was part of a circle of young Australian students who were spreading the doctrine that Australia was part of Asia, not part of Europe, and that they should be open to Asians they were agitating to completely open all the immigration restrictions and allow everybody to come in from the Orient into Australia. Well, he had spent the summer in Tokyo, in Shinjuku, which is it's like a vast collection of alleys and bars and tiny rooming houses. It's where the Japanese, quote, bohemians and hippies hang out, except there must be 2 million of them in there, you know, up and down these alleys and so forth. He'd spent a summer in the Shinjuku, and he'd met Nanao that summer and had spent 6 weeks with him reading his poetry and translating some of it into English. He told me, when you get back to Japan, you must try and meet Nanao. I did, about a year and a half later, meet Nanao, and I met his circle, which was at that time about 4 young guys who had dropped out of the universities in Tokyo and had come to him, so to speak, for guidance in education using the Fugetsudo, a coffee shop in Shinjuku, as a headquarters. And Nanao had changed his traveling pattern so that he was spending 3 or 4 months every year in Shinjuku being available. Then the other 8 months of the year he was out wandering and begging. What he did with those young fellows was See, Japan has got an old feudal heritage, which means that younger people look up to older people and actually do what they say. And so, you know, with this kind of spirit still going, they said to him, now, what should we do? And he said, walk to the northern tip of Japan and come back, and don't start out with more than 100 yen in your pocket. And when you come back, I'll talk to you again. And so he laid trips like this on people. I mean, literal trips. And then what he would tell them to do is, he'd say, well, read Herodotus, read Thucydides, read Sima Qian, the Chinese historian, and read the ethnographies on the Toda of the Nilgiri Hills, of the Bushmen of the Kalahari, and Pitt Rivers, or whatever his name is, ethnography of the Australian Aborigines. That was his educational program. He also got a lot of them involved in translating pre-Socratic Greek fragments into Japanese. And they started an underground newspaper later, and the very first translations of pre-Socratic Greek philosophy ever published in Japan in Japanese was published in an underground newspaper. Also, the first translations of Milarepa, the great Tibetan poet, into Japanese first appeared in the same newspaper. So they've been right ahead of things, culturally speaking. 5 years ago, there were maybe three or four people that were working with Nanao like this. I met all of them at that time. They came down to Tokyo, to Kyoto, where I was living, and where Allen Ginsberg was visiting Joanne and me there. And so they came down, they met Allen too. Allen has had his finger in everything that goes on this globe somehow. He's got an incredible knack of being somewhere right when somebody is about to start doing something. And give him a pat on the back, you know. And then later they say, Allen Ginsberg showed me how to do it. It's wonderful, really. We saw the same thing happen in India with that group of poets around Calcutta that call themselves the Hungry Poets. Well, I came back to America for about a year and a half. I was out of touch with Nanao. When I went back again, what had been half a dozen people was now about 300 people. And it wasn't just boys, it was girls too. And when I saw girls in that group, I said, the revolution is beginning. Because, well, it's just like Joe Hill says, it's great to fight for freedom with a rebel girl. You know, in that song, The Rebel Girl. That really makes a difference. Before that, they had been just a bunch of freaky male dropouts who were dirty and long-haired and were wandering around. But now they were beginning to have something happen that was like a community. They started publishing little underground magazines and little bits of their poetry. They began to give poetry readings. They read the Japanese translation of Kerouac's On the Road and loved it because they'd been living on the road. They couldn't understand a lot of it, but they liked it. They used to come and ask me questions about some of the things going on in it. About that time, they began to have a real impact on certain levels of Japanese Marxist, revolutionary, avant-garde cultural thinking. A very funny impact, because it was not, it was anti-urban slightly. So they were the first push of anything outside of a completely city-fied, sort of European imitation of avant-garde thought. In the heart of Tokyo, and the reason they were able to do that is because they had so much actual physical background of camping, living, walking in the mountains and in the hills, working as loggers, you know, and so forth, working on construction gangs, drinking cheap sweet potato alcohol with the workers, and then working in Tokyo to make money by picking up dock jobs, day laborer on the docks. No union there either. They were breaking several precedences. One was they were literate people who were like involved in the arts, who weren't afraid to work with their hands. Now, the Japanese intelligentsia is still pretty much in that old Asian tradition of a literate man, an artist, does not work with his hands. To the contrary, these people had been in and out of jails, which they call ushigoya. Ushigoya is the name. Pig. What's the word for pig in Japanese? Butagoya. This is an old slang term going all the way back, long before we invented the term pig here. They called jail the butagoya, the pig shed. And they spent a lot of time in there. So they weren't like the rest of the Japanese intelligentsia. They weren't even like the rest of the Japanese Marxists, who are also kids with very clean hands, for the most part, especially in the intellectual worlds. And they finally got it into their heads to get out of the city altogether. Well, Nanao remembered back on one of his trips down in the southern islands, south of Kyushu. About 1961 or 62, he had hitched a ride on a little interocean steamer between Amami Oshima and Kyushu, a run of about 200 miles through open water there. And he'd gotten into a conversation with an old farmer, an old fisher farmer on this little ship, who said, well, I have an island not far from here that's really underpopulated, and told him all about it. So Nanao went and visited this island, I think about 62 or 63, and they were there just during a typhoon. It was in August, and so they couldn't get off the island. He couldn't get off the island for 3 weeks. He said that he was just running around helping everybody tie their roof down for 3 weeks. The population was 40 people. The number of houses was 8 houses. That was the whole island. Nanao remembered this island, and he wrote a letter to this old farmer and said, would it be all right if about 20 of us came down there? They said, yes. They'd like to have more people. They've been losing their population for the last century. as the young kids go into the cities and become industrial proletarians, making a little more cash and living in incredibly depressed circumstances, but still perhaps, you know, economically superior to the condition of the island. So they had lost steadily all of their young people. From 200 years ago, the population was maybe 200. So 3 years ago, they first went down there, 20 people. I was down there that first summer and started clearing sweet potato fields out of the bamboo jungles, building little shacks out of bamboo and driftwood and the logs that they cut off of the mountain, and starting a commune, which they named the Banyan, after a huge banyan tree which was nearby. And the whole place being dominated by this huge smoking live volcano, which the island is, which erupts mildly and throws smoke up in the air once every week, and about once every 2 months blows up enough so that you have a hail of ash and small stones and sort of get indoors, unless you don't mind it gets in your hair. And their commune has been going now for 3 years, functioning very nicely. They support themselves by fishing, spearing fish, netting fish, diving for various kinds of edible shells, raising sweet potatoes and vegetables, and stringing cowrie shells for beads, which they send to their friends up in Tokyo who sell them for them. That was Nanao's work. He also started another commune in the mountains of Nagano Prefecture along the same lines, a place where it gets very cold in the winter, and that place is still going, with about 25 people living there. And they maintain a kind of a communal house in the center of Tokyo, where people who have spent some time at the island and some time at the mountain kind of recirculate back to Tokyo for a few months to pick up on the gossip and the politics, and to earn a little cash money. The girls go out and hustle. They work as nude models or waitresses in coffee shops or hostesses in bars, which is a way a girl can pick up cash fast in Tokyo. The boys have to go down and work on the docks. And then they recirculate the cash money back to the country communes again because they don't have much cash there, not even for buying tools. And, as I say, they published for a period, for about a year, an underground newspaper, which was called The Tribe. And they are known in Japan as the Buzoku, the tribe. In Japanese, Buzoku means tribe. And I should also add, as a matter of cultural history, it's no accident that when they split off from the Barb, they called the new newspaper The Tribe, the Red Mountain Tribe, because they had that group in
they knew all about that group, and they knew about that newspaper. Keith Lanfey and some of the other people of the tribe knew about that. And that was part of the influence of that, was calling it the tribe. So those communes are running pretty well now. One of the poets involved in it, named Nagasawa, who calls himself Naga, just came back from a year knocking around in India. And since he came back from India and is able to take care of things a little bit, Nanao came to America in July, and he's been here in America since July. We were backpacking in the High Sierra this summer, and he went down into the bottom of Grand Canyon after that and chanted sutras. And now he's down in the Southwest, where he's spent, I think, 2 weeks living at Taos with the Indians. They took him in. So this is a funny and, to me, delightful set of cultural conditions and circumstances working. And he'll be going back next July. He'll stay here 1 year. What he came to America for, he said, was not to see America big, but to see what a big desert was like. And to see what a good solid continental mountain range from the Jurassic was, because they don't have any ranges like that there. He wanted to see some really good granite. They don't have that kind of rock in Japan. And he said he wanted to see his brothers, the Indians, because about 40,000 years ago, they started on a trip from somewhere in Central Asia, heading east, and somewhere along the line they split into two parties. One party took the southern route and followed the land bridge out into the Japanese islands. The other party took the northern route and came over Bering Straits, which was dry shod then, 40,000 years ago, came down into America. He feels that. So when they say when they say red power, they mean something else too. That's what Mao means when he says red power too. I think Mao has got the American Indians in the back of his mind. So now I'm going to read a few poems by Nanao Sakaki, which were translated originally by the Australian poet Neil Hunter, and then I went over the translations again with Neil's permission, and I made some changes too. So it's a joint work. Nanao is a native Japanese surrealist poet, I should warn you. These poems are called Bellyfuls. First, I love you, feels the darkening window dummy's rough powder snow mixed with a white wink, passing under seven waterfalled breasts with, in the night, the spreading sound of all-or-nothing rapids, following charred rock skin scarring fingertips Mary's lover leads a suffering ass and opening tobacco-reeking fly yahoo. It is. But because the semicircles are misunderstood, the dance floor stumbling slopes on tongue and semen vehicles of lies, why is the smoldering stump of virgin green rain frog before a sudden shower, turns horizontally around the upright tea stalk chipped from sun, end of umbilical horde of labor pains, dwells only 1,000 up from slaves in front of stations of commercial law and body height, whores, lengthening, dazzling, lightning flash, begonia's nose, impaling hope's smeared grubs on sticks for food. All the climate of misprint. So one day with sea-parted, stiffening crane is tangled in hard bread of hungry souls and bamboo grass of debts. The irritable call hooks on the steps of mistweed, dull alibi stallion withering, cairns crumbling townful buildings while the tail of Constance trembles on a lizard does not bend 100 years. Mountain stream of idle conversation, rainbow avalanches, sperm on alpine roses crimson weak, counting clock tick falling stones, lifting the healthy third leg along the tooth marks of cruel crampons on a butterfly, over diagonal model globe goes bankrupt in stiff constipation and the cut thread of a previous offense. Disturbance arc, continues in abundant turpentine for freezers full of loving couples. Naive magnet pointing south. Cubed expression depths from physiology turns round steam turbine stammer drum breast. Throbbing in big sister's kite on string, gouging yesterday out of the blackhead of a tomb. Comparing lengths of burnt-out butts that chant the finger-ordering haiku, worn-out retirement brush, as blossoming in the spray of a heat haze, to approve the Milky Way shaft, drowning in pachinko lava and caterpillar's image of the shiver and echo, twittering fossil state of human love. Rumbling brass band of the moon's spear takes off nightless widow's weeds and is the veil of tears rains down from diapers soluble in pawn forfeit heroes dangling from cracked mainmast responsibilities and the medium line death penalty, so saying you with dynamite in mouth, love, nakedness. Yeah. He refuses to write anything other than that. I literally, he's only written this many poems in his life and has been a total influence on the Japanese poetry world. No one in Japanese has ever written like that before. And the Japanese original of it is pretty interesting. And he is intellectually articulate and precise to a frightening degree, but he has very pure views of how much one should say or how one should say it in poetry. So he continues in that vein. What I just read is noted, he wrote this at Okuchichibu. The next one comes from Yakushima, which is one of the southernmost islands. Under the four rainy seasons, what are you? Scaly ferns growing from prominent navels, rotting permanent waves, hurrying up the hypotenuse of a squall, split from the gray and pubic hairless sky, on big-bellied women vipers in long raspberrying shaggy banyans of black breasts, and the twin thunderclap of crystals and great cedar felling clear weather coming out in wheels. Pre-Old Testament angle of elevation, twine, about the cold and beautifully naked passion fruit splitting open on forest crosses first flow, sentinel rocks of others, dolmen of the stiffening flying fish at fire sight, onion peels and missing leaves, whirling and spreading out on horse face in its everlasting jungle of weekly magazines. And the next, in the regular service of sampan and pork soup's chopped up gramophone record of flypaper, fuzzy in the ears of the dormouse burning with intestinal worms, this is mankind? The hill of greening banana boy's virginity, piling up in drops of dialect, musty as the far-off asthma of the nightingale, standing on the blood group of rhododendrons, hinds that wet their pants upright, rough-textured placenta of public opinion, and typhoon winnowing granite, the lie of rich sugar content, spraying on the one-price-only daydream, dimming illegal opera glasses, root strike in ghostly tropical grass, astrology continuing as split-second bargain counter, speed of cheap hips more vertical than the devastated cliffs afterglow of burning stakes of kanas in the suspended sentence summer. Playing card permutations become a melody which wills shame on itself in sluggish, comb-dried mackerel pieces, washing the ultraviolet rays and the primary colored angry string of islands parasites on white of egg conscience. Why shouldn't you, exhausted cotton waste in swamp of fallen trees, stay the perfectly mannered speed of sound at peeling off the skin of salary? because of phosphorescent insects, warming up of memory, the wind velocity of mossy mushrooms in the mask of a rusted mirror, twice solidifying the lens and the stratus cloud, so with surrounding sea and vault of heaven, all yolk of eggs, between us and the annual rings, the flowing plural menses. Glad to see you people like this stuff. I was kind of afraid to read it. Number three. This was written at Hokkaido on the Shiretoku Peninsula. At the opposite, absolute opposite of Japan, the one I just read is written from the subtropic oceanic place. This is written from the subarctic Siberian place. In slacks of bones because of chewing cows, please spread ticks tangled in saliva, stingy octane rate. Great colts feed on wide junction of the sulfur-smelling new moon-clouded creeping pines and summer solstice-striped mosquitoes full of blossom. And wait for me where the murder rate is in full flower. On steps of cumulus, while I, next to the mountain stream of crow and squint, wind up the rocky hill piled high with brown bears, spring dung curling in the snow ravine rear mirror. Cut across the northern latitude, horned owl, who loves to rip the transient leaves, gas smell, suburban manners, and false teeth of brock and avalanching down sound bell in alpine birches. Feel the twitching veins of wolves who hasten in unison their own weathering. Swallows Delta, welcome news, agglomerate standing out distinct from fern triangular waves, line up on elephantiasis benches overhanging shelf erased potassium stain. Burn the seal zigzagging up the meeting tides. The red rose is over made up on the carpet snow. Heaped up ponytails waterfall behind the heel of my self-portrait. Fall in sleet on border only. Obtuse angled prison terms of drift ice pile up balancing accounts. I don't know where he wrote this fourth one. Stand up, snakes. Exclamation point. Bursting the basting threads, twisted on, twined on beetle palms, you, leaf veins of hungry panties. On the desperate banana tree, sliding down the papaya trunk, sliced up sail you stake your life on? In lists, scorched by high interest, keel of random rainfall, stopping your ears to the star and anchor, menacing reef and roar of breakers, summer orange, a burr in the throat. Caught on chest hairs of star coral, bloodshot from camellia, wolf in sheep's clothing, stones on roofs. Bearing defiant bums, the momentary crimson bank deposit. Always glaring from the cliff of square of monkeys and the pantomime. In a forest of pygmy ants, turned rosaries on the necks of dummy flowers that nod, yes, yes, to neon. Waiting vine of false morality and watermelon physiognomy. Greasy with the mascara of cycads and yawns. Eruption should the bougainvillea culminate. Take off bare feet of harmony. Noodles whirling on the wave crests of a cherry blossom snowstorm even pigs can't bear. camphorized bridal night swimming through rice fields of inflammable heat. After warm, palm-vomiting current, northern limit of pimp traitor to the world's time deviations. I wish he was here. And the title poem from this is called Number 101. It's a little different style. Emerald Sky, he translated this himself, incidentally. Translated by the author, right? Emerald Sky, leprous sea, what wretched dreams I'm dreaming. Always mooring a sampan. I hope to get free of timidity just now breaking out. Stripping myself soul's nappy, it's a bargain. At the end of a scene with your ghost, I went up the ravine. Came back through New Year's spit-smelling, charred pile caressing evening calm. Then spongy future peers into the morning mist of honeyed words. But you can jump right over it like crickets. Eternity is supper for sows. I, myself, Jack, ate an overflowing silence in summertime. Pubic hairs of human history devour a damp crater plus the placenta, sink to the lake in midwinter, sleep to satiety. There goes a Christmas party of mice in the kitchen. There goes the singing of ardent spirits on the beach. There comes vomit to the eardrum. There comes a blizzard merrily. Happiness calls back, bellyfuls of falling stones. Let's have coffee, business, and creed. False red peppers come down silently to the timetable. But you can smile if you could. Next is a scabby calendar. Tore off a sheet, it says, I love you. Take care of French pox in a crescent moon, naked teacher, misery carrier pigeon, a tower clock in a park. You and your stone image are going down to the sun. Artificial flowers or jets of waters, perfumes. Hey, skylark, higher and higher. You may fall down to heaven. If you want to love something, it could be the wind of Greek letters, or the tomb of duty getting sober. Once more, ding dong, a chimpanzee is the very image of grandfather. Namby-pamby footprints over there boiling hamburgers, narrow lane of spherical clusters.
This is over. I have to finish it 3 minutes. Yeah. So, another translation. I'm going to read a couple of translations from some of Nanao's sidekicks, too. But while I remember it, I want to recite this translation. I did this from the Song Dynasty poet Wang Yangming, Wang Yangming, 12th century. It's one of the most perfect little quatrains ever written, probably. These people lead their lives awake as though asleep. Lao Tzu in the mountains sleeps, yet is awake. Sleeping, waking, both are not, and yet both are. Clouds and streams forever, water cold and clear. Isn't that nice? Just about says it all.
I don't want to change the tone too much, but I'm going to follow with a poem by Mao Zedong. This is one that I translated. Professor Chen Shixiang over at Berkeley, who was my Chinese teacher many years ago, once told me, and he's no communist particularly, but I mean he has no particular sympathy for Mao. He said, there's no doubt about it that Mao Zedong is the finest Chinese poet of the 20th century. And he even went on to say, maybe 900 years from now, or 1,000 years from now, Mao Zedong will be remembered in the Chinese histories as the 20th century's greatest poet, who also dabbled in politics. As you know, Mao writes in the classical modes, though, and in the introduction to one of his Chinese editions, he says very strictly that the younger Chinese poets should not copy him, that they should not write in the classical style. He's an old fogey, and he doesn't know how to write in any new free form, but he advises them to go on and find their own forms. This poem is called The Long March, and it's a classical poem in the five-character line, which means it has five characters to a line with a caesura after the second character. The rhythm is basically tse, tse, ping, ping, tse, no, wait a minute. Oh, this is a seven-character line, pardon me. This is a seven-character line. Tse, 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 ping, 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 like that. Dum, 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 dum is the basic rhythm. Two, two, caesura, and three. I've tried to keep a little of that rhythm in the translation. The Red Army has no fear of the long march. 1,000 mountains, 10,000 rivers won't stand in our way. For us, the five ranges are little rippling waves. The pinnacles of Wu Ming roll by like balls of mud. Cloud-wreathed cliffs are warm, washed by Gold Sand River. The great iron chains are cold that leap the Tatu Gorge. Drifted snows on Min Shan only make us gay. The Red Army to the pass, on every face a smile. Another poet in Japan who has been involved in the tribe is Nagasawa Tetsuo, who calls himself Naga. Naga is a devotee of the great goddess Kali, and just came back from a year's trip to India, where he hung around Kali ashrams mostly, and spent a lot of time in Nepal too. The first, I might add, of the Japanese people of this time and this group to get into Indian culture. Like they got their finger in, they got a hole in the dike now, and so after that, the deluge. This is, he's very much like Nanao, that is to say, rather surrealistic. Au I Lu Mahara. This is a selection from a poem of his called Au I Lu Mahara, which has no meaning, those words. I mean, it's not Japanese, it's not anything. And these words in here are not Japanese words, they're his own magic language words, some of them. Nevu kama yut uru sogu nu abammu kammu ummu tummu himmu shishimmu kaimu rammu tammu kru ru ru sasan ruined wallways. Varnished coffin lids. Uem, nem, nem, sem, rose thorn, tunnel, sand-sick inner bark of stupor, rose-thorn breath of lava, sea, earth, slackened. Changing water, ev, death by water, ev, deep gorge, ev, ev of snow egg, making rounds, collecting, ev, earth axis, ev, stand up tautly, wrapping, ev, nude, ev, scorched earth of reed fires, sunflower slushy, on the floor, on the snow, fatty altar hands, ev, nude. One more poem of Naga's that he wrote while he was in India. A little devotional piece. Om Ah Hung. I feel perfect of it on white. I feel perfect of it on blue. I feel perfect of it on red. I feel perfect of it on green. I feel perfect of mind, disappearing into perfectness of it. Perfect is being. Being perfect is knowledge. Knowing perfect is bliss. Om Ah Hung. I guess our time's going to work out just right. Only one more poem here, and that does it just fine. Now, this is Yamada Kaya is this poet. Yamada is a really beautiful cat. He's the main man for holding together the Banyan commune right now. He's an artist. He worked as a professional designer of kimono patterns for a while, too, to make money. He's a hunchback. And, you know, in Japan, people can be very cruel to cripples and deformed people. But he has come through that, you know, like really purified by it, like with just an incredible loving cheerfulness, comprehension of people and their weaknesses and their strengths. And he made his living for a number of years after he quit being a commercial kimono design man, sketching in bars, you know, and doing the whole little hunchback juggler trick thing to get the money and to get the people to let him draw them and drawing them and then stashing away the money and then buying a fishing boat. This is his poem, which is called In and Out. Dreaming, 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 to inside from outside, a dream in wings, a wing in snow, snow in lovers, a lover in white ships, red moon, moth, flame, singing, 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 to outside from inside, a white ship around chimpanzees, a chimpanzee around windmills, a windmill around starfishes, a starfish around a fortress around foams, a foam around a chameleon around dawn, smoke, shell, water. Walking, walking, walking. The inside is all. A dawn in coconuts. A coconut in dead bodies. A dead body in snakes. A snake in yawns. A yawn in express trains. An express train in the breast. Bread, beggar, air. dancing, dancing, dancing. The outside is all. A breast around primeval forests, a primeval forest around a calendar around roses, a rose around lips, a lip around reefs, a reef around balloons. Parachute, window, wind. Prayer, prayer, prayer. The inside is nothing. The outside is nothing.
Thank you for coming, and I'm sorry there wasn't more time, that we got started late, and I'm sorry the room is so crowded.